Welcome again, record producer John Custer. We're so glad to have you here.
Glad to be here.
We've heard wonderful things about you from Missy Biggers. And we know, at least I know, that a couple of the bands that you've worked with are Corrosion of Conformity and Big Something. And boy, those that the Corrosion of Conformity is really doing well, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
That's amazing. So, you know, one thing that I wanted to ask you was, when I saw on Facebook, you posted a song that you performed a long time ago.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And when I asked you about maybe playing the guitar today,
right,
you said that you don't play the guitar anymore. And
no.
Then I listened to that song, and I just went, oh, my God, why didn't he play the guitar anymore? How did you go from being such a great guitarist to...
The benefits of being that particular kind of great guitarist are a lot of little boys with black T-shirts that say Fender on them. That's about it. That's it. That's all you get. If you're metal guitar players that are like trick guitar players, that was in vogue then.
Right.
But it became a cartoon when everybody was trying to out Van Halen and all those kind of guitar players that came.
Right.
And I liked, as a kid growing up, Marvin Gaye and the Jackson 5 and funk-oriented music. And I noticed when I wrote those kinds of songs that there weren't boys with black T-shirts showing up. It was something else. So I preferred that. And it was much more of a broad range. I only played that guitar style because that was the style you had to play to tour back then.
Right.
And I was a touring guitar player. I was 19 and 20. So I decided to go into writing and producing and making records because they're permanent. If you play a great guitar solo in a club one night, you know, did it or did it not happen? It sort of vanishes into the ether, right?
Right, right.
Records are forever.
Yeah, that's true. Mm. Don't you miss it, though? And I mean, you're so talented. That was the thing.
Well, for people who can't see you, tell us when back then was.
Back then was 30 years ago.
Wow.
That much. Yeah,
something like that. When I was...
years?
I'll be 50 this year. So it was when I was 19 and 20.
Wow.
You know, back then. So it was the...
So when did you... How old were you then when you decided to become a producer rather than a musician?
When my band, that one that I was in, won a recording, free studio time, right? And this producer came in and... it was awful. What actually came out was so awful that I just imagine anybody with a kid watching them get burned alive or something like that. Same kind of thing.
Oh.
And I walked out of there and I said, you know, this should never happen to anybody. You write some song or a poem or whatever, a movie, and it comes out as the antithesis of what you had in mind, what your original intent was.
Right.
So I moved to New York.
And from where did you grow up?
Cary, kind of Cary.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh, I didn't know anybody grew up in Cary.
We did, yeah. I was, when I grew up in Cary, it was the old kind of Mayberry
version. The
one
street, yeah. I remember that.
And we were transplants from New York, my family. So... my parents were very hardcore about not getting into the provincial attitudes that were there at the time. Certain stances on race and things like that, right?
Right.
And there was a big influx of Yankees. I think they call them that we were. So we kept to ourselves a lot, and my mom and dad kind of instilled in us that you either achieve and you win and do, or don't do it at all. That kind of thing.
Right.
So I wanted to go into production, so I decided back then, Piedmont Airlines, if you remember Piedmont Airlines, offered a
Bow 29. Used to be a what do you call them?
Flight attendant.
Yeah, $29 round trip.
Wow.
To New York. So I went every other weekend, started making connections in New York.
So was that like in the 80s or something? Or
that was 84. Mm. 84, 85, something like that.
Right.
And I just kind of found the best people around here to be my mentor. I had Obi-Wan Kenobis everywhere, you know, the older guys who were really good.
Right.
And I'd tag along with them and ask them questions, and they just taught me how to do things and how to be, everything about music is more psychological than technical. If you can get a great artist comfortable in a headspace where he can just do what he does in a club or at home or in a rehearsal space, they're going to give you that amazing performance.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So,
well, and you seem to have a real skill to bring out the best in the musicians that you work with.
Yeah.
You know, I was reading a little bit about you, and all the bands seem to sort of, what do I want to say? They sort of see you as a god.
Yes, yes. Well, that's because I've got this electronic cloud that runs on D batteries, and I ride around on that. No, there's a... the reason why they probably have that kind of a feeling is because if you're producing someone, you need to care about their music as much as they do.
Right.
When you can articulate that to an artist, mm-hmm. they appreciate it like a father would appreciate somebody saving his daughter's life.
Right. Yeah.
It's the same thing. This is their legacy. You know, if this doesn't happen, they have to default to something else. The dream thing is gone.
Right.
So I try to help them get to the next level and the next level. And all of my artists have. You know, I've been a real snob about who I've picked to work with, because there are a lot of guys doing it out there for commodity. There are a lot of guys doing it out there for girls and drugs and that kind of thing.
Right.
So I don't work with those people. I work with the people that want to have their music go to the four corners of the earth. Every available organism that would like their music would get a chance to hear it. That's what it's about, communicating with the planet.
You want your groups to live up to your parents' expectations for you.
Yes. Yes.
If you're going to do it, do it the best.
No, yeah. That's true.
That is true. You know, if you're going to do it,
yeah,
do it the best. So you don't miss playing music at all?
I play music occasionally. but it's usually got a comedic thing. See, when you don't play for a long time, your hand turns to concrete.
Right, yeah. Right.
And the stuff that I played was very, you know, it was athletic. And I can do Neil Diamond so well. Because my mom used to buy the Neil Diamond records, right?
Oh, yeah.
That most of the time when I come into clubs, and if people know me, they do. You got to do Neil Diamond, right? So that's right. Isn't that what happens? I end up going out and doing Neil Diamond.
Well, you do a little Neil Diamond for us.
He doesn't have his guitar with
you.
Have
your guitar? Does he sing anything without
I keep thinking you're going to pull something out of your pocket and play it.
I don't know. I miss it. I do. But there's a finite thing here. Your ears, if you pound them all day in the studio,
yeah.
And then you go out at night, and COC is not a brushes and clarinet band. Mm-hmm. It is the loudest, most devil-horned music you've ever heard in your life. Mm. And
that's
you watch
Corrosion
that.
Of Conformity, right? Yeah. The band that you work with. One
For
of the
22
bands.
Years I've been
Wow,
working.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Dang. Yeah.
Yep, we started to work together in 1989 on a record called Blind.
So it's like probably second nature between you all now. I mean, you just say, do it like this, and they do it. And
right. We are all Yes, we're veterans of the same pirate ship, yeah.
Right.
And we've done a lot of, yeah, there's a lot of stories. But it kind of goes into the whole thing of now you know that there's an advocate always and for the right reasons. And all the things that you're doing, if we want it to sound like death, if we want it to sound like the worst possible, like the crucifixion, it's going to happen. You know, no matter what we have to go through, we're going to make that original intent of the songwriter, and we're not stopping until fruition. So that makes you all brothers in a sense, because it's a war. You know, you have to fight to make it happen.
Right.
So we're close. Yeah.
So did when you first started playing music many years ago, or producing music, did you ever think that 30 years down the line you'd still be doing this? Did you know that this was like your thing forever?
Well, I was counting on Daredevil. You know,
stuntman.
That kind of thing. Because the helmet, you know. No, yeah, I did think so. I was. I looked up all those guys, Jerry Wexler and Phil Spector, although I've got to take out the whole shoot the girl in the mouth thing. But, but yeah.
That's probably a good idea.
I did think I'd keep doing it because I met Jerry Wexler when I was doing a record for a band called DAG in Muscle Shoals. And it was about 2 years before he died. He was doing an Etta James record there. Mm. And this kind of skinny Santa Claus guy walking down the hall. And he walked by me and I realized, that's Jerry Wexler.
Wow.
Yeah. Mm. So I shook his hand and he was like, looked like a train conductor or something. But I met all those guys. I got to hang out with these legendary guys, and they took a liking to me because I cared about legacy recordings and analog recordings and the way that they used to throw harnesses around things that seemed impossible. In Muscle Shoals, the Rolling Stones were there for 3 days. They couldn't get a work visa in America.
Wow.
So they snuck in, right? In the 3 days, they recorded Brown Sugar, Wild Horses, and You Gotta Move, right?
Dang.
Well, wow. Their producer did not show up. So the guy who did work the session called me into his office one day. His name is Jimmy Johnson. Very animated guy. He's the guy that played guitar on all of the Aretha stuff. He was one of the Swampers, you know. Jimmy Johnson, David Hood, Roger Hawkins, right?
Right.
So they played on everything Aretha, from R.E.S.P.C.T., the house that Jack built, blah, 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 all that. So he liked me, and he said, come in here, I want to play you something. So he plays me this thing, and he says, you know, I didn't play you this. So it starts out, and it's Johnny B. Goode.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's Johnny B. Goode. And the song starts, da 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 da. You see this vocal, and it stops. The song stops. I can't figure out what the hell is that. It sounds like the Stones. He's like, it's the Stones, but what song are they playing, right? And I says, listen. So you hear them talking, and they start it up again. Da 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 da. Johnny B. Goode, right? Mm-hmm. Song starts, plays, right? Can't figure out what it is. Stops again. Talk, 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 talk. Right? And you hear Keith Richards unplug his guitar and plug in another guitar that's obviously an open G tuning. And you hear Mick talking to Charlie Watts. And Charlie Watts is switching over from the hi-hat snare thing to the floor tom thing, right? And the next thing you hear is dun, 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 dun.
Wow.
And they play Brown Sugar, right? First time through, right? He says, all right, now listen to this. And they try to do it again, and they can't do it again. So they did it once. He said they did it one time.
Wow.
Yeah. That's so you've got to have the stuff rolling when they do the magic thing.
Right, right. Or you could miss it just like that.
Yeah, they played us stuff that, I mean, it blew my mind. Outtakes of Otis Redding and Sweet Soul Music outtakes and stuff like that. Stuff that is holy grail music, you know.
Wow.
We got them to come out to dinner with us and just tell stories about staple singers and Aretha and Wilson Pickett and all that.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah. That's some really legendary performers.
Yeah. When was that?
That was 91, 92, 93. I did three records there in Muscle Shoals. It's gone now, you know. It's gone.
So what brought you back to North Carolina then? Just because it's your home or...
Well, yeah, my mom is here.
Oh, we have just a few...
About a minute?
Yes, I'm sorry.
It's my mom is here.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, and my friend Neil Chapman and I started a studio here, and I just wanted to provide...
So what's the name of your studio?
John Custer.
John Custer. Yeah. And if people want to find you online, it's just johncuster.com, right? Mm. So what do you have in the works right now? Anything exciting?
There's going to be another record. It's a spinoff from the guys in Corrosion of Conformity. It's called Righteous Fool. And it's Reed, the drummer, and Mike, the bass player, and a guitar player named Jason Browning. So we're probably going back to Dave Grohl's place in Los Angeles and finishing that.
Nice. Boy, you lead an exciting life, don't you?
Not really.
No. A lot of work, right?
A lot of work, yeah. Yeah.
People think it's all, you know, glamour and glitz. And
but then there's WCOM showing up for us. And
yes.
Yes, and thank you so much for coming. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
We are out.